Hi and hello, Watch fans, and welcome to another edition of The Real Time Show with me, your friendly neighborhood watchmaker, Rob Nuts, and our friendly neighborhood jeweler, calling in all the way from Amsterdam, Alon Ben Joseph. By popular request, we have decided to kick off today's Q&A session by running through the recent releases from the LVMH Watch Week. We've got releases from brands such as Bulgari, Tag Heuer,
Hublot,
and Zenith to discuss. And we are going to have a lot of fun with this until we get round to the rest of the questions that are still busting out of the mailbag. Okay, Alon, I'm going to kick it to you to begin.
Before I do so, I want to throw you a curveball.
Uh-oh.
What I was most excited about, LVMH Watch Week was and used to be, for several years, only four brands. But if you paid attention, it grew to six brands. Because we had Gerald Genta, Daniel Roth there, with the guy that I admire the most within the LVMH group, Jean Arnault. But to answer your question, I ordered the new Zenith, which I forgot to mention in our previous episode.
For goodness sake.
Which was not launched, weirdly enough, at LVMH Watch Week, which is the Chronomaster Sport, full titanium, full satinated. And I can't wait to put it on my wrist because I pulled the trigger without even seeing it in the flesh because I did not fly out to Miami. But to answer your question, Bulgari did cool stuff, nothing crazy. They brought back the 1975 Bulgari, designed originally by Gerald Genta in a 38 and 26 millimeter versions. Cool. Nothing spectacular. Nice that they did it. Line extensions. Octofinissimos got a steel version with a Tuscan copper dial. And we have a full yellow gold one with a blue dial. Line extensions. Again, obviously, it wouldn't be Bulgari if they didn't do something with Haute Joaillerie Serpentes. And what I kind of liked is they changed this bracelet on the Lucea. It's a watch that I really like for ladies. It means light in Italian, Latin Italian. And the strap was a prisma, a hexagonal shape. And they add a link in between. Super cool dials. The one I was my favorite was the Malachite Mosaic pattern. So they literally created a dial of little pieces of green malachite. I don't know any other brand that has done such a dial. So that was very cool. Kicking it back to you, Rob, what did you think of the Bulgari novelties? And please jump to Tag Heuer afterwards.
Okie doke. So I was quite charmed by the new Octofinissimos. I thought they were low-hanging fruit as far as line extensions go, but the Tuscan copper dial is really nice. It's a nice alternative to the rest of the line, and the yellow gold one is gorgeous. I don't think it would rank ahead of, say, the full satinated rose gold model of the past for me, but I do like a bit of yellow gold, and I do think that this is a really worthwhile addition to the collection. But, you know, nothing too groundbreaking. I am a fan of the Bulgari Roman coin-inspired watch from Gerald Genta, and I'm really glad to see this one back. I love the rose gold one with the silvered matte opaline dial. I think it is just a very pure design, classic Bulgari, easily recognizable, and although not exactly cheap, certainly more versatile than many precious metal watches. The Lucea, absolutely agree with you that this is a bit of a surprising but welcome addition. The bracelet is a bit more edgy now. I would say it's sort of nods to Serpenti vibe in some ways. It's a bit more like the scales of a snake or the articulation of its body, which is nice to see. But that malachite dial is gorgeous. I have one criticism, only one, and that is I wish that the red crown had been drop type for a green malachite crown. I'm not sure that red and green really work together that well. Christmas time, brilliant. This is maybe the perfect Christmas watch. It looks a bit like a Christmas tree with all those diamond indices on the dial. But I also must commend Bulgari for cleverly using all of the broken bits of malachite that they haven't been able to find a use for from their previous malachite models that obviously were just, you know, cluttering up the workshop. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not the most elegant mosaic. It does actually look like broken ground, you know, like arid earth, shall we say. But I mean, they found a use for that stuff, and it's pretty striking regardless. I'd be interested to see how robust it is over time. I would ask your opinion on that, but you've already asked me to move on to Tag Heuer, so I will do. Let's go over to the new Tag Heuer Carrera chronographs, and there are two green dial versions that I'm looking at in front of me here, and they both have this beautiful concave dial, the dished dial, that is, have to say, as much as it pains me, something I absolutely love. I've never been a fan of Tag Heuer in general. I was a fan of the old Heuer pieces much more, and I've never been a fan of the Carrera. I find it to be a bit of a blockish and thoughtless design for the most part, but the recent revamp of the collection that uses a style that starts out swooping up and under the sapphire and then drops away into this central bowl-shaped area that has all the dial information, it's just brilliant. It's so much more characterful than everything they were doing with the Carrera in the recent past. I think it gives Tag Heuer a brilliant aesthetic USP to lean on. And here, with this chronograph, two options, like I say, there's one with a 30-minute counter at 3 and a date at 9. I love that reversed layout. I've always loved it. I always think that it's something that brands should do more, even though some people would argue the date should always be the most readable thing as the watch slides out from under the cuff. But why not make the chronograph the focus of attention when it is the complication of the day after all? And then the other one, the Tourbillon. I mean, for goodness sake, this model actually carries the Tourbillon very, very well. It fits. It looks good. It's not brassy or in your face. They've made the smart decision to use only silver-toned components for this so that it matches with the colorway really nicely. I think it's brilliant. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. And this is a Tag Heuer. Before I go through the rest of the Tag releases, let's get Alon to come in and give me his feedback on the Carrera.
I am happy about several things. I love the vintage datograph. So chronograph, single subdial, and then the date kicked to another position than that we're used to, either 3 o'clock, 4, 5, or 6. So I'm happy about that. I am happy that we see again green, because that sets the tone for a trend that still endures. We've seen a lot of green. Apparently, 2024 is not done with the color green, or the watch brands for that matter. I'm happy for selfish reasons, because one of the collabs I'm dropping very soon, which I designed almost 12 months ago, Freudian slip there, is green. So I'm happy about that. I loved the glass box Carreras. I do love Carrera. I've owned many Carreras. I still have vintage Carreras. So unlike you, I've always loved them. I only have one criticism for Tag Heuer, is they pushed prices up too fast. But this brings an interesting timestamp to both our podcast and the industry, because just before LVMH Watch Week, we had big announcements. We knew there was some musical chairs coming up at LVMH, but our dear friend Julien Tournant from Zenith moved to Tag Heuer. Frédéric Arnault, who was at the helm of Tag Heuer for many years, got promoted to CEO of the watch division within LVMH, and he reports again to the CEO of LVMH watches and jewelry. So that's a position that has been created for him. Now, I'm very curious what the ex-COO of Panerai, Benoît De Clercq, a Belgian veteran in the watch industry, will do at Zenith. I'm curious what Julien will do. Will he push it up more? Will he pull a 180 a la Jean-Claude Bivel? What he did at Tag Heuer, he democratized Tag Heuer again, went down in prices again. So all of these watches that we see at LVMH obviously were not of the hand of the new CEOs at this brand. Hublot stays where they are, so no CEO new there. Bulgari There were rumors that Frédéric Arnoult would go there, but he didn't. Babel stays there. Our dear friend Antoine Penn stays where he is, doing an action job, obviously with Fabrizio Bonamassa there. So no changes there. Now, I'm very curious if Julian is happy that Tegoria revamped or relaunched their sunglass collection. So, Rob, hit, miss, success. What do you think of them making sunglasses again at Tegoria?
No.
Do you think Julian is happy?
I don't know how Julian feels about it. I hope that he's happy. I hope that he's happy every day. He's a nice man. He deserves to be. But for me, sunglasses and watches, why? There's a way for a brand to do both, but it has to come in an order for me. The ones that make most sense are when you've got a brand that starts out as a fashion house and then makes extreme investment into a watchmaking division that has credible output. And then you can say, okay, like Chanel, for example, Chanel sunglasses make sense to me. Totally fine. I don't like watch brands going the other way. I know it's not exclusive. I know we have an interview with Dan Niederer of 7 Friday in the can, and I can't wait for everybody to hear that one. And I like what 7 Friday did with the glasses because of a certain price point. And it's kind of funky and it's kind of cool. And maybe that's the only way that it makes sense to me to go from watches to accessories. But I'm a bit of a stickler for this. I think I'm a bit of a stick in the mud as well. And I think that you can accuse me quite rightly of being stuffy and a bit too conservative. And I'll just wear those criticisms because I think they're probably fair. I would say I like my watch companies to make watches. I like my sunglasses companies to make sunglasses. I like my fashion companies to make haute couture. That's it. Basically, I like branding to be clean. I like product lines to be concise. And I think that this is unnecessary. I am now leaning towards Tag Heuer positively in a way that I haven't done ever before. And if I could ever imagine myself buying a Tag Heuer, which is still a stretch perhaps, I definitely wouldn't buy Tag Heuer sunglasses. No way.
Going from sunglasses back to watches, the Solargraph was launched, I believe 2 years ago, but could be last year, has been a success. I can echo that success because I've sold many of them. The market likes them. They took them to the feminine side of the Aquaracer collection. I salute Tag Heuer. They've always gave the feminine side of the brand and therefore the feminine side of wearers, the ladies, attention. Just think about the Formula One, the F1 watches back in the 80s. They always made smaller sizes when they made the men sizes. So that shows that they've never ignored women, and up until today, they don't. So I salute them, and they took it from volume pieces of quartz Solargraph watches to the third plasma diamond, the Avant-Garde watch. Again, a spectacular piece. So lab-grown diamonds, and they made a full dial out of diamonds. The hour markers are baguette-cut diamonds. The logo is a shield, a yellow diamond, and the full crown is one yellow diamond. Spectacular Carrera case. I like it, although I'm not a fan of lab-grown diamonds per se. Another connected watch. Can you guess what color, Rob?
I'll say green.
A warp, ding, 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 ding. How easy to guess. Do you want to add anything to Tag Heuer or should we jump to Hublot?
I definitely want to add something to Tag Heuer, and I want to comment on not the connected watch. That one is what it is. It's fine. Green strap, green bezel. Well done. I think that some of the Solargraph dials, well, one in particular, the kind of turquoisey green, pale green, mint green, maybe you could call it one, is really, really nice. I think that it's an interesting proposition at that 34mm diameter. I think it's a cool watch. I'm quite impressed by it. It's not for me, obviously, but I think that color is really gorgeous and a nice touch. But as for this Carrera Date Plasma Diamant d'Avant-Garde with yellow lab-grown diamonds, I absolutely love it. I love, love, love it. I think it's super cool. This reminds me of the last plasma experiment Tag Heuer had, which also piqued my interest. Surprisingly, I wasn't expecting it to. But yeah, man, this is absolutely stunning work. It's a little weirdo, but it's lovely proportions. It's got affordable movement inside to keep the overall price down. But the yellow diamond crown and then the yellow diamond on the dial and the diamond dial is just, it's mad. But it's lovely. You know, the white strap, the white leather Croco strap that it's presented on, it ruins it for me. And I think that it will actually distract a lot of people like me who would be interested in this watch had it been on a black strap or a brown strap or something. I could actually see this being a pretty good watch for anybody. It's 36 millimeters. It's very wearable. It's a unisex size, the Goldilocks size, as they say. And it's such a baller piece. I don't think this needs to be looked at as simply a feminine model. Although that white strap gives the vibe that that's what they're pitching out. I just think it's cool. I think it's science. I think it's very, very, very nice. So I'm all for it. I don't think I'll be adding one to the collection, but I would absolutely love to borrow one from somebody who has 90,000 francs to spend on it. So with that in the bag, let's go to Hublot. Oh, I mean, the MP10 Tourbillon weight energy system titanium, which has these vertical winding weights, two of them on either side of this, I'd say, Apple Watch shaped case, is the star of the show. This is the best release. This is what Hublot does well. It's what Hublot does possibly better than any other brand in the industry. I wrote a review on it for Revolution magazine, and I was just gushing about how cool it is. And I'm sure the 50 pieces will have sold out before we can blink. And they're at a price point that are way, way, way beyond mere mortals to attain. But I mean, come on, it's cool, isn't it?
I love it because I am that futuristic MBNF UEG type of lover. That's what it is. You're right. 50 sounds a lot for a quarter of a mil, but probably they'll be picked up by, as David has taught us, Hublot fans, but also probably those fans that are looking for a very technical, futuristic, pebble-ish watch. But since you wrote a review about it and you are a watchmaker, what does it actually do and what's so innovative about it? And I, by the way, salute that Hublot is doing more and more of these things and doesn't keep on cranking out Big Bang collabs and limited editions.
Okay, well, it does a few things that you would expect and a couple that you wouldn't. The most obvious thing about it is this digital time display, which is in the middle of the watch for the hours and the minutes on these rotating columns. And then at the bottom again at 6 o'clock on an angled 60-second tourbillon, which has a numbered ring around the outside to show you the passage of time as it moves. So that moves constantly. That adds a real activity and dynamism to a watch that is already pretty exciting to look at. There's a power reserve indicator in between the tourbillon and the digital time display in the middle of the watch. But the really exciting thing is the vertical winding weights on either side. Now, these are sprung. So if you shake the watch really, really hard, you're not going to get these these winding weights clattering up and down. The jeweled bars they're on, they will like cushion themselves against extreme motion so that everything's safe and the operation is reliable. It's not like we've never, ever, ever seen vertical winders before. In fact, in pocket watches, they weren't, I mean, they were uncommon, but they weren't unheard of to have a weight that slid across a vertical track and back and forth against these bumpers. And talking of bumpers, of course, Omega very commonly used bumper movements in the 50s, 60s, 70s, which had an auto weight that didn't complete a full 360 rotation of the movement. It would do about 260 maybe, and then bounce into these spring-loaded buffers to prevent any kind of damage to the watch. And yeah, it was a clever little system at the time for winding efficiency, or so they thought. And I just think that this is very cool. Is it necessary? No. Is it more effective than a regular round rotor weight? I mean, it's hard to say until it's been on the wrist for some time. I would guess probably not more effective than a bidirectional winding circular weight, but there are two of them, so maybe. I think the most exciting thing here is proof that it can be done, that it can be appropriately miniaturized, and that it can be made to look quite as cool as it does in this setting. So full marks for me. I mean, we haven't even talked about the formation of the case and that incredible sapphire that swoops around at multiple angles in a kind of blobby cross form just to reveal all of that wonderful work inside. Next up is the Hublot Big Bang Unico Green Saxum, another watch that I reviewed. Now, this watch does cost around 100,000 francs, which is a lot for a basic chronograph. Although I have to say, I did similarly gush about this because I love the Saxum material. It's like sapphire, but it's colored with rare earth elements. And that's why you have this incredible homogeneity of color. And actually, the crystalline structure of Saxum and sapphire are different. I believe sapphire is composed of triangles, whereas they say Saxum is composed of cubes. And that's supposed to mean that the luster you get from the polish, the reflectivity and the color homogeneity is improved. So it is a typical Hublot thing. It's a development nobody asked for. It's a development that probably nobody needs, but it's something to talk about. And it certainly does look striking. The green rubber strap that comes with this model may be a step too far, and perhaps it would look a little better and a little bit more under the radar on a black strap. But then again, if you're going to spend six figures on a Saxum Hublot, under the radar is probably not the look you're going for. One thing I did pick up on in my review, which I have kind of overlooked with every other Hublot chronograph that follows this format, but they're technically big eye chronographs. I don't know if anyone really talks about this, but the left-hand subdial at 3 o'clock is actually much larger than the going second subdial at 9, which again, I agree with because it places emphasis on the chronograph complication. Nice touch, nice design dial, a classic movement for an ambitious watch. So I'm a big fan of that. Do you like Saxum, Alon? Is it your kind of thing?
I think it's cool. And if I would ever buy a sapphire cased watch, it's going to be an Altia. Watermelon.
Oh, you want nano sapphire. Well, that's something different entirely. It's not sapphire. It's not Saxum. It's nano sapphire. The best of all the sapphires.
Yes.
Yeah. Fair play to Altia.
Yes.
Going from Hublot.
Let's go to Zenith. What did you think about the triple calendar? So the big bang was new caliber for Zenith, therefore a revival of a iconic watch. Triple calendar used to be the 410 caliber. Today it's the 3610. So the second hand on this watch does 6 rotations in a minute for the chronograph as well. What did you think, Rob?
Well, I actually think it's disgusting. Lee Good. Pull the curveball there. Yeah, no, I really like this. I really, really do. I think triple calendars and annual calendars are not as common as they should be in the industry. I think I remember telling you about a JLC annual calendar that I borrowed once for review and was completely unimpressed when I got it. And then by the end of the week, trying to sell my organs to buy one because I fell in love with it so hard. And I think that the Zenith triple calendar here is exactly the same kind of proposition. I think the Chronomaster case is about as big and edgy and aggressive as you could have with a triple calendar. And for me, I would wear this watch on a leather strap. I would definitely put it on a brown padded leather strap almost as soon as I took it out of the box, because I think that it would reduce its visual weight on the wrist significantly and add a little bit more congruity to the layout, especially the moon phase. A moon phase next to a bracelet never really sits well with me, I have to say. But I love the placement of the day and the month. I love the execution of the design. Finishing is typically Zenith. Movements, excellent. Big fan. Really big fan. Good price, too, for a triple calendar.
I am 100% with you. I love what they did. I ordered all colors. When I posted it on my socials, the green one got the most love and feedback. Green, green, green. So very well done. Very commercial. Yesterday, I actually had a one-on-one training session with the head trainer in Leloc. Great guy, full of passion, really knows his stuff. So we jammed a bit. It was great fun. They technically only launched during LVMH Watch Week, 3 watches. So we have the triple calendar in 3 colors. You have 2 Chronomaster Sports, and that's it. Again, green. So we have the Chronomaster Sport with a green dial, green ceramic bezel. And then you might say, hey, wait up. You guys don't know your stuff. That watch already exists. If you do know that, kudos to you, dear listener, because they made a special edition for Aaron Rodgers, the NFL star player who is a Zenith ambassador. He got his own watch, but that watch has numbers and the regular Chronos Master Sport doesn't. So they made a green version with the tricolorous sub-dials now available in stainless steel. Then they came out with a big bang. I'm not talking about a Hublot. They made a jeweled piece, which is spectacular, fully pink gold, bezels set with three kinds of gems, which are gradient, and then the hour markers are natural white diamonds, all GIA certified.
This is gorgeous. It's a beautiful finish dial, beautiful use of diamonds. But I have one question. Look at the bezel, right? You've got three different colored diamonds to match off with the tricolore subdials, right? White, blue, black. Now, this is, I think they've done this because of how the subdials overlap, how the 3 and the 9 overlap the 6. But did you notice that you've got 21 minutes of blue, 21 minutes of clear, and then 18 minutes of black when you divide the outside track? Did you notice that?
I actually did not, because I, as a jeweler, fell off my chair simply because I'm like, whoa, I love the play of 13 blue sapphires, 13 gray spinels, 14 black spinels, and then 10 diamonds. So I fell off my chair, and the dial is gold colored meteorite as well. So I'm like, whoa, what's going on? I'm like, wow, I would never wear a jeweled watch. And how much I shout at Tutti Frutti all day long and I admire it and love it, I would never wear one. But this suddenly, I started tingling. I'm like, I would maybe wear this because it's subtle and because the inner subdials radiate out to the bezel. And they've done this already with the boutique edition in steel, if you remember. They made a three-part ceramic bezel that has these three colors. But well spotted, Rob. I have no idea why they did this. But if you look well, they did the symmetry exactly with the hour markers of the 4 and the 8. So when you look at the picture of the... I have a picture in front of me in the document they sent to retailers of the bezel, just gems. And then it looks odd, but they made it symmetrical with the cutout of the hours on the dial, and they've done so with the full ceramic tricolore bezel for the boutique edition.
It's very interesting. I like what they've done. I think it's cool. It works. It's just something that I noticed immediately. I was like, oh, hang on a second. The blue and the white stones extend one beyond what you would assume would be the natural hour marker point for them to end at. But I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong. I think it looks fantastic.
You know why? You know, they messed it up for themselves, because if it wasn't a striking 10th chronograph, so you know Zenith has a patent on the fact that's the only chronograph that spins 1/10 of a second, meaning 6 times in 1 minute. So they needed to put the 10 diamonds there.
Yeah, that's it. So it's 10 diamonds, not 12, yeah.
Exactly. And then you're out of step. Suddenly you're like, oh my gosh. But they solved it well, because it's super, super difficult to cut these gems like this and to make them interlock. And spinels are relatively soft. Sapphire is hardness 9 on a scale of Mohs that goes up to 10. Spinels are a bit softer. Super difficult to find them, A, in the same color, B, to cut them that precise in a circular motion, because they are in a squarish shape. So as a jeweler, and I'm not a gemologist, but I am a diamanteur, it blows my mind. So, you know, I was so mesmerized, I didn't even notice it. So they've done such a good job. So really, kudos to Zenith. Price, €106,000, and 100, I don't know, well, for the box probably.
But if you have $100K to spend, and if you are a Rainbow Daytona gal or guy, give them a chance. You'll enjoy this piece.
Yeah, I mean, I have to hold my hands up because my initial analysis was wrong. I was focusing on the position of the 10 markers around the dial rather than the 12-hour markers. And you're right, of course, that the blue lines up with the first 20 minutes, not 21, as I said, and the first and the last 20 minutes. And there are actually more black stones than there are either blue or white, right? Because the black one actually comes up higher. It's a bit of a mind melter when you look at it at first. You're like, oh, they're not balanced, but everything balances. How have they done that? Look, end of the day, I love it. I think it's superb. Again, though, maybe too much rose gold. Maybe I could live without the bracelet on this model as well, but perhaps it would lose some of its freshness. But I mean, what a cool concept, a way to freshen up the Tricolor. I love it. I think it's wonderful. Oh, and just one more note about the green Aaron Rodgers special edition. Don't forget that the accents on Rodgers' version were also yellow. So this is quite a different one without the Arabic numerals and the yellow accents. So
correct.
Yeah.
And going back quickly to this gem set one, I want to give a shout out to Yoshida, one of the best retailers in Japan. They make crazy collabs. They are a silent force. We stumbled upon them with watchbase.com, and they were actually the first to get the jeweled Chronomaster Sport. And not just one, they have two. They have a Tutti Frutti rainbow, pink gold, black dial, and they have one that's fully diamond baguette set. If you want to check it out, just type in Y-O-S-H-I-D-A on watchbase.com and you'll find all the collabs that Yoshida's ever made. Just filter out Zenit and you'll see they had 16 Chronomaster Sports collabs. Imagine that. That's berserk. But then, LVMH Watch Week ended. Suddenly, a week later, out of the blue, Zenit sends not even a press release, just posts on Instagram, a full satin finished gray Chronomaster Sport. It blew my mind. I had to send a message to my brand manager. What the heck is this? Can I get one for my private collection and for the store? So, little silent force is the only Chronomaster Sport that is fully satinated. And there is a bonus. This is the first year you can get a rubber strap for all the Chronomaster Sports. So you might remember that about 3 years ago, they launched the Chronomaster Sport. White Tricolor subdials, black Tricolor subdials, either on a steel bracelet where the middle link is polished, or a black fabric Cordura strap on the black and a blue one on the white dial. Those straps are gone. You can still order a replenishment strap. If you want it on a new one, you can add one to your order at your Zenit AD. But today, all references have an option to choose the metal bracelet or gold or a rubber one. So what happened? The black and white dials have black rubber on a folding buckle. It's the same folding buckle that's on the Cordura strap. The boutique edition with the Tricolor ceramic bezel and the blue one with the stainless steel bezel have a blue rubber strap. The Aaron Rodgers ones and the new green one have a green rubber strap. The titanium, obviously, you can opt for a black one. And then there is a white one. You can find it on the pink gold white dial one. But if you have a Chronomaster Sport already, you can go visit your Zenit AD and order any color you like. That has been confirmed during the training I had yesterday. Going from Zenit now to Gel Genta. Rob, what did you think of Gel Genta? Because I believe Gel Genta and Daniel Roth presented the watch, but technically we knew they were coming. So are they hardcore novelties? I don't know. But what's your stance on the retro Gel Genta with Disney figures, Rob?
Well, I gotta say, I like it. It's fun. It's basically the only time I'd want a Disney character on my watch, I think. I'm not sure why I find it so acceptable when it's Gerald Genta, but it just seems to fit. I think it's a funny old watch. Like, it seems a very specific design. You know, it's the birthday cake and whatnot, and you know, the hour hand, the jumping hour, should I say, and then the retrograde minute hands just swooping around this celebratory scene of Mickey in a little party hat. I think it's fun. It's never ever going to be something that features on a want list of mine, but I think it's okay, and I think for its audience, it's fine. What I do love, though, is Daniel Roth these days. I love the case shape. I'm so glad it's come back. I didn't get it its first time around, but I really do now. And I think that there's a dearth of different shaped cases with identifiable silhouettes in the industry. I think this is a really, really good one. Tourbillons are never my thing, but I think it's always great to have more options within a house like this. And I do like the second indication. So what do you think of those two?
I love him because historically, we obviously now have a big boom of collabs with cartoon figures and Snoopy revived it a bit. Omega did it with NASA's Snoopy. So it's the Snoopy Award. And then everybody jumped on the bandwagon talking about Timex. Bamford, who does it well on his own watches with Frank Mueller, etc. Today, it seems that every brand has a Snoopy watch. We have seen collabs with Marvel. We've seen collabs with DC, etc. So we think it's normal. But a cool anecdote is that Gerald Genta, when he launched his own brand, so he's always been a ghostwriter, meaning he's a designer who did not get an assignment and worked for a brand. He literally designed stuff and then would shop around. So he came up with the integrated bracelet sports watches and then literally go have take meetings with Patek, Audemars Piguet, IWC, etc., etc., and they would turn down or accept his designs. And then the brands would make it as if it's their own, right? Only years and decades later, we understood that it was him. In 1984, he launched his own brand, Gerald Genta. And that was at the 1984 show called Montre et Bijoux in Geneva. That's the predecessor of SIHH, which today is called Watches and Wonders. He launched there with a Mickey Mouse, a Pink Panther, and a Sailor Man. And he got kicked out of the fair. It was a scandal. They thought he was crazy. He was a disgrace to the watch industry. What was he thinking? So therefore, that story is even more epic. At a certain point, he sold his brand to his dear friends, the Tay family of Hourglass. They, at a certain point, were owners. The brand was not that successful, became dormant. Then Bulgari bought the brand in 2000 from the Tay family. And Bulgari shelved it for quite some time. Then in 2021, I believe, Antoine Penn made some re-additions with jumping hours and retrograde watches with cartoons on them again. But they didn't revamp Gerald Genta's brand. That kudos goes to Jean Arnault. He's so excited about it. He dusted off the brand, pulled it, plugged it out of Bulgari, made it a standalone brand within LVMH, teamed up again with Evelyn Genta. So that's the widow of Gerald Genta, who's still alive. She runs the Gerald Genta Foundation, who owns all the IP for the old designs, and I believe they have a foundation. So he married those two separate entities again, because I believe she's affiliated again with the watch brand Gerald Genta that's owned by LVMH, and LVMH does not own the foundation. So that needs to be said. So I am all for it, not only because I love cartoons on my watches, always did and always will do, and it works because I've said it probably on air. During lockdowns, I visited my dear friend George Bamford in the Hive in Mayfair, London. Took my son back in the day. I believe he was 4 years old with me. What did he resonate on? The Mayfair watch in full red with the Cookie Monster on it that he knows from Sesame Street. So after his tour in the Hive,
literally George took him around took him around the atelier and all the floors, but due to the lockdowns and COVID, I was not allowed to come with him. But my son was and still is kind of shyish, but he clicked with George. George is good with kids. He's a good dad. He has kids. He loves kids. So my son went with him alone. So I did not have the tour. My son had the exclusive VIP tour with George. After 10 minutes, they came back. He had loads of stickers. And then I bought the Cookie Monster, and then George gave him the watch. So cool story. But you see, it works. So it resonates with the inner child. And old geese is like, well, me, you're not that old, but I'm an old geezer. But it also works with kids still today. So it's cool to see.
You're very kind to me. I think I'm only about 6 years younger than you. How old are you?
I'm 44.
Yeah. I'm 38. It's not that bad.
But you have the midlife crisis luring.
Mate, I've been having a midlife crisis since 1996. So I am a walking midlife crisis. Everybody knows that. All right. Okay. That's it for LVMH. We did skip a couple of Hublots. Olinsky. Nice.
Hold your horses. We didn't talk about maybe the most beautiful watch present at LVMH Watch Week in Miami. I don't think it's a novelty because it's the Souscription Daniel Roth Tourbillon, which is basically a replica. But dude, let's talk about it. Daniel Roth, did you like it when it came out? His watches, when Mr. Daniel Roth launched his collection, the Papillon collections, and those, I don't even know what you call the case shape. What do you call that case shape? Rounded with cut edges.
Let's just call it a Roth, because there's nothing like it. But I don't know where you were, Alan, but I've already talked about that one. I love it. I think it's wonderful. I think it's great. I'm really happy to have it back. No, I didn't get it the first time around. I only recently fell in love with it, but I'm as the kids of the day say, I'm there for it, or am I here for it? I think I'm here for it. I'm somewhere for it.
Is that a new say?
I'm where I should be for it, I guess. I think they say I'm here for it or something, like when something happens that they like. I've seen it on Instagram.
Sorry, dude. I said you're not an old geezer, but now you are an old geezer as well. Because we both have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah, all right. I love it.
Jay. For it. Yeah, I missed that. You know what? I was so sunken in my thoughts about thinking about the Zenith Chronomaster that I tell my wife, yes, I hear you. I just didn't listen. So I probably hurt you.
You were so into the Zenith Chronomaster, you dived into Zenith before we'd even finished Hublot. I was thinking, what about Olinsky? What about the Spirit of Big Bang? What about them? I mean, to be honest, they're just line extensions. So fair enough, we moved over them. But now we've mentioned them, so fine.
No, let's talk about the Olinsky. I actually think that was maybe one of the coolest collabs I've ever did. And I love the, I believe he's called Muriaki, the Japanese artist. The floral guy. But Olinsky is, I think, very cool. And it was a match made in heaven. It is the avant-gardistic DNA that Hublot has matches with Olinsky's signature, his design code, his design language. So I kind of love that indeed.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. It's an enduring partnership now, and it's one that has become, I wrote in the article about it, it's become its own thing. It's almost like its own brand, the Hublot-Olinsky thing. Now, do people buy that because it's a Hublot, or do people buy it because it's an Olinsky? And that's what you want from a collab. You want to pull new audiences into new product spheres, and Hublot succeeded there. It's extremely on brand. It fits with everything. Extremely on both brands, should I say. So I love it. And just to clarify, you're talking about Takashi Murakami.
He's, I should have known. My childhood friend was Takashi and Murakami. Yeah. I think that's very cool. If I may, Rob, I know we kind of want to round it up, but since this became an LVMH special, which we didn't intend on doing because we wanted to breeze through the novelties quickly, we thought six brands and we'll do it in less than 30 minutes. But this became an LVMH special, so since that's the case, let's run with it. I kind of want to ask you, what do you think of these musical chairs of CEOs? And since we love to play the game
of what if we were a CEO of a watch brand during our article analysis with David we'll share on the show. I'm going to do that with you quickly. So what would you do if you were now CEO from Tag Heuer coming from Zenith? And what should Benoit do? And what would you do? You understand? So I'm asking you two times, two questions. So for each brand, what would you do? And what do you think the CEO should do? Or what are the challenges that they're facing right now?
To the first question, I don't mind this musical chairs of CEOs that we see. It's certainly not within a group. I think it's fine to take the experiences from one brand, the specific experiences from one brand, and be installed at the head of another company that you probably already have a pretty good idea of its daily operations, because you'll obviously be sharing information with one another, not all the time, but I'm sure they're quite well connected. So I think that that's fine. It's more like just spring cleaning, like freshening up, you know, a fresh pair of eyes, maybe. I think it's a bit of a shame that CEO positions in general are such a closed shop. And I see this in my other great love in the NFL, you know, when there's a head coaching position available, you get a couple of offensive or defensive coordinators being elevated to those positions when they've served their time. But mostly the main candidates will be head coaches that were just recently fired by another team. And you kind of think, would it not be cool to just grab somebody a bit more obscure or give an opportunity to people who don't often get to serve in those positions? Of course, this is big money we're talking about, and people err on the conservative side a lot of the times. But, you know, when you get a real visionary in place, good things can happen. When you get somebody who's hungry and has a different idea of how things can be done that isn't a company man, shall we say, you can really turn it on its head. However, with brands like Tag Heuer and Zenith, I don't think they need to be turned on their head. I think Julien did a wonderful job at Zenith cleaning up the product line, really getting the Defy to take off and now be a very established and respected model. I think the new Chronomaster has hit its stride with this release. I've always been a bit on the fence about it as a direct competitor to the Daytona, but I think they're doing good things there. What do I think the new CEO should do in that role? Poor. I think that they should continue to build out the collection and brutally discontinue models that are either a bit long in the tooth, and by that I do just mean like two or three seasons, like get a turnover in there, don't limit the pieces, but you know, make it that if you're going to refresh a collection, don't end up with the situation Omega is in with 450 DeVille references. I think that's too much, too confused. I think brands need to be leaders on what is available and what the style of their brand is, and not just throw as much stuff at the wall and see what sticks. Tag Heuer is going in a good direction. Now, the increase in prices that you mentioned before is probably very relevant to what Julien will be doing. He'll probably be trying to raise up the entire portfolio to bring everything up to a level where it operates at a hitherto unaccessed bracket. And I think the most interesting thing that they're doing is with this lab-grown diamond technology that they've developed with the plasma models that they've sparingly but occasionally released. I think that that's a great way to throw out a marker and to show what the very, very top end of a brand like Tag Heuer can be, which I think by osmosis will elevate people's perceptions of Tag Heuer as a brand and make them more comfortable paying the prices that are being asked for the pieces that were previously more mid to low high end prices and now sort of getting into that five figure bracket. So those are my immediate takeaways. What would you do if you were CEO of both brands?
Interesting what you said. So I think Benoit took a very risky position or timing of taking this position. So Julien did the same. So Zenith maybe has not been profitable since the 60s, maybe 72, and then it stopped. They've been taken over by the Movado Group, the Zenith Radio Corporation, and it's been musical chairs all along and never made profit. The legendary, the man, the myth, Jean-Claude Beaver did some good things. People say Philippe Dufour created magic at Zenith. He didn't. What he did is after the Nataf era, which Nataf did a good job by putting it back on the map, but didn't create commercial pieces, but did kiss the sleeping giant, as he would say himself all the time.
the fool is a great CEO. He's very commercial. He's a silent force to be reckoned with. He's modest. He's silent. He's basically a sniper. He understands what works in the watch business. He took Zenit back to what all brands always do when a crisis hits. Go back to the basics. Make classic watches. Don't do crazy stuff. So he made a pure manufacturer again, did a lot of dress watches, took pricing down a bit, and then he got poached by Rolex, and boom, he is the star that he promised at Zenit, because their slogan is reach your star. Then Bever stepped into LVMH, was responsible to Zenit. His idea was to marry the past with the future, which I think was smart because he pumped a lot of money into R&D to revive and evolve the El Primero, which he's done well. Remember the inventor with Guy Simmel? So that was basically not the first, but the first high frequency silicon watch that got a lot of press, because a lot of people forgot that Parmigiani Fleurier created the Saint-Fin watch, which I don't know why died a very silent death. But Jean-Claude Bivet didn't really make a cash cow out of it. He made a cash cow out of Hublot and then sold it to LVMH. And that's how he got into LVMH. He did it at TAG Heuer. So I'm doing a dual segue into Zenit. It is really Thierry Nataf who turned around the brand. He is obviously Bivet's protege. So kudos to Bivet, because he's seen what rough gem he needs and gave it the podium that it deserves. And he really also rose to the occasion. He reached his star, Julien Tourneur. In the beginning, very briefly, he got criticism by creating the Cornermaster Sport because, he's lazy and he just made a Daytona lookalike. But that criticism faded very quickly because it became a commercial success. And a lot of Daytona owners bought it. And then the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? But he's done a lot of great things. Think about doing retro, vintage-inspired watches. He's done new calibers. He's done ultra-modern with the Defy 21, with the Defy Sky Skyline. He did do some feminine watches, but on the marketing side of things, he has that Hearst project, which is amazing. A lot of ladies work at Zenit because we had him on air. So if you want to listen back to that episode, just check it on our website, therealtime.show. And I don't think he was done, but I agree with you. Fresh blood is always good, especially if it's an internal musical chair and not from external. They indeed share a lot of data, but not everything. I assume all CEOs come together when they have extended management team meetings and extended board meetings and executive board meetings. Now, but he's done a great job all around. So the question is, will Benoit be set up for failure right now? And where is he going to take it? Zenit, in my humble opinion, does something right. They understand they need multi-brand retailers, family-owned retailers. They do a bit of monobrand, but they aren't blinded by the fact that they need to go fully LVMH, Louis Vuitton model of fully verticalized retail. And they did push up prices, but not too much. Is it fair that a super chronograph like an El Primero is around 10, sports around 12? Yeah, it was lower, but everything moved up. I think the pricing is okay, but Benoit should not go crazy now, in my humble opinion. If I was Zenit, I would stay the course, embrace the duality of both your collection of heritage models and keep doing revival of those stuff, and also embrace the modernity and the cutting edge of what you can do as a manufacturer, which they are. Now going to TAG Heuer, Julien, is he the right guy for TAG? Yes, because he's just simply a great guy, good CEO, knows the watch business. I believe he's always worked in the very high end of things at Haute Lingerie. TAG Heuer isn't Haute Lingerie. And I think that's what he needs to fix. Kudos to Frédéric Arnault. I think he did a great job. I personally, if I was the CEO of Tag Heuer, wouldn't dig so deep into connected watches. So I would have cut that. But I don't think that Arnault will allow him, Julian, to cut the connected watches. So that's a hot potato he's stuck with. And I would not only stop that accelerated growth in prices, I would not only stop it, I would turn it around. I would make sure at Tag Heuer they still make watches below 2,000 because they left that price segment. And that was the first thing Jean-Claude Biver did. And I dare to say that he saved Tag Heuer back in the day because they were really speeding up to the cliff. So those are my 2 cents. I have way more ideas, but I think we really should stop this episode. So thank you, Rob. Thank you, dear listeners. The outro is yours because nobody does it better than Mr. Nuts.
Mr. Nuts, I might start putting that on my business card. I love it. So I think we probably should pick up this conversation about the musical chairs of LVMH later down the line, maybe 6 months or 12 months time. We'll have a better idea of exactly what these two gentlemen in their new positions will be planning to do with those companies. If you have any questions for us about today's episode or would like to add to the mailbag, then please get in touch. You can do so either via our dedicated Instagram channel at therealtime.show or via the contact form on the website, www.therealtime.show, or you can hit us up at our personal emails, either Rob or Alon at therealtime.show. We'll be back soon with more articles, more interviews, more question and answer sessions. Until then, stay safe and keep on ticking.